dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The name Evan Sayet probably conjures up images of a man you can turn to for epic humor. That is, after all, his stock in trade. He is a very accomplished comedian, the creator and star of a marvelous show, The Right to Laugh, a night of conservative comedy. He formerly wrote for such extraordinary comics as Arsenio Hall and Bill Maher in their respective programs. But he has a very serious side as well, one that has been noted by those who have read his book, Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks, and the lecture that he derived from it for the Heritage Foundation, which is still, I believe, the most viewed in the history of that organization, which is saying something. He is now the author of a brand new book, which we've invited him to speak to us about for this full hour. It's hard to imagine a more timely and more needed essay in the long form than The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. Evan is a good friend and a very admired and valued colleague, and I couldn't be more pleased to have an hour to spend with him talking about the woke supremacy. Welcome back, Evan Sayet. It's good to have you with us. So, woke, of course, is a term that most of us associated with just a bodily condition until fairly recently. Tell us what is meant by woke and what the woke supremacy involves.
Right. Look, the woke is a standalone, fairly newish ideology. I obviously didn't coin the phrase. They coined it themselves. And the irony is they love to believe they're anti-supremacists.
Now, that they here needs to be defined, Evan. I apologize for breaking in, but tell us who of whom you're speaking.
Yeah, those who, first of all, identify themselves as woke. As I say, I didn't invent that phraseology. They did. But they're also the woke enablers. So let's just look at the cities. I would say it's the woke who are violently rioting, but it's the woke enablers who are the mayors, who are the governors of the states, who literally, as in past supremacist movements, turn their back as the others are being attacked.
So city councils and, for that matter, I guess, people in certain law enforcement agencies who at least are bending to the dictates of some of those other enablers.
As well, Frank, let me interrupt for 1 second, but as well as the news media, which falsely reports that these are peaceful demonstrations when in fact they are violent riots. The tentacles of the woke and the woke enabler. And keep in mind, every supremacist movement, whether it was the Nazis, whether it was the white supremacists in the Democratic Party Old South, the actual activists, the true believers, only comprise about 10% at most. See, that's true of the Islamicist supremacists as well. But it's the other 90% who have been so steeped in the narratives and the orthodoxies of the supremacy that they simply go along and give their support without a single moment's thought as to the truth or the morality of what they're doing.
Okay, so we've got, I think, calibrated the kinds of people who are involved in the woke supremacy, either as direct participants or as enablers. But what is the belief of these people? What is the ideology, I guess one might call it, that they are trying to impose on the rest of us?
Right. The true believers, their goal is simply the destruction of the world as it is, in order to then replace, to build upon the ashes of their destruction, this utopian socialist ideology that they embrace. The vast majority of people who enable the movement, however, haven't read Das Kapital and say, yes, Marxism is the way. Though the vast majority have simply been steeped in the notion that all thought is bigotry. Anything that you believe, anything that I believe, anything that your listeners believe is going to be so tainted by our personal prejudices. Prejudices we all have, we can't help but have just as being human beings. Anything we believe is so tainted by our prejudices that the only way not to be a bigot is to never think at all. And so what the true believers have done is make it a moral imperative to be a useful idiot, to simply not use your mind to arrive at the better and more truthful conclusion.
Now, when you use the term the true believer, there is a certain intellectual tradition here. Eric Hoffer, of course, wrote a remarkable book back in the 50s, as I recall, a longshoreman, but he saw firsthand what true believers were like, how they behaved, and it fits this pattern. But Evan, you were talking about this in the specific context of an anti-socialist manifesto, if to refer to your subtitle, of the woke supremacy. When you say socialist, are you using that term in a way that encompasses so-called democratic socialism, that encompasses communism, that encompasses Marxism? I mean, or is this just a unique phenomenon that is different from the others?
Well, one thing that is central to the woke supremacy, the book, is that I separate ideology from the system. Right? The system of socialism, which, by the way, is no different except in perhaps some cosmetics from communism. You know, in communism, the government has all power, all authority, and has all ownership. Whereas in socialism, the government still has all ownership of essential production, and you're allowed some non-essential possessions, but even those are so heavily regulated by the state and so taxed by the state that ownership under socialism is simply a name only. So there's really only a cosmetic difference, and even the communists recognize this, which is why so many of the communist states call themselves socialist republics. You know, even in Marx's theory, he spoke of socialism as nothing other than a way station, you know, a halfway house between stealing all of our property and all of our rights. They simply steal almost all of our property and almost all of our rights till we get used to it, and then they go all the way to communism.
I think of it as kind of the entry-level drug that gets you hooked, and the rest of it is inevitably going to run its course to the point where you have lost your freedoms, you have lost, you know, your sovereignty, you have lost, you know, your rights.
All of the above, in fact, and even your humanity, you know, your ability to think freely, to practice your beliefs freely.
Hold that thought, because, Evan, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to drill down on those losses, because at the moment, there seem to be an awful lot of people in this country, particularly among the young, who find this very appealing. And the seductive power of that entry-level drug is not to be underestimated, nor is the ultimate agenda of those who are purveying it. We'll be right back with more with the great Evan Sayat. He is the author of a tremendously important new book entitled The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. Stay tuned for much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with an extraordinary, well, I think of it as Renaissance man. He is gifted in the extreme in comedic activity. He has perfected the art of the stand-up comic. He brings to it the perspectives of a conservative comic, no less, which makes him an unusual individual, shall we say, in Hollywood, where he lives. But he is also a deeply serious thinker about some of the most important, most uncomic things of our time, like, will we survive as a free people the subject of his new book, The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. His name, of course, is Evan Sayat. We are so pleased to have him with us, and to have both his insights as well as his friendship is a great privilege. So we were talking before the break, Evan, about this phenomenon of socialism and whether one sees it close at hand in places like the Soviet Union or Cuba or Venezuela or communist China. It's pretty unappealing. And yet we're witnessing this incredible, well, to use the Star Trek terms, tractor beam that seems to be operating with an awful lot of people in our country, mostly young people, who seem to think socialism would be just the ticket for them and for our country, for that matter. What's that about?
Well, first of all, they're not being told what socialism really is. The true believers, the people who are behind this movement, are selling, are engaging in a bait and switch confidence game, where they present it as one of the Nordic states. You know, they want to turn us into Denmark, which basically the only thing they know about Denmark is that they have universal health care. They know nothing at all about their actual system, about their culture. And in reality, when the Prime Minister of Denmark came to America and addressed the students, we're not talking about high school students or junior high school students. He went to the Harvard School of I forget what it's called exactly, politics or political studies at Harvard University, the Kennedy School. Yep, the Kennedy School. And he said, I know that many of you in America think of the Nordic states as having a socialist system. I want to make one thing clear, he said. We are not a socialist system. We are a free market economy. The idea that he had to educate these people at the best schools just shows how little they actually know about what they're being sold and what they're going to get once the revolution has succeeded.
And, you know, there's something here, though, Evan. I think it's fair to say that the Nordic nations experimented with socialism at various points, the Swedes and the Danes, at least. And where he was coming from, I suspect, was not simply just trying to clarify the record, but expressing the revulsion of people who have dabbled with this, experimented with it, as I say, for what comes with it. No?
The Prime Minister of Sweden was watching a Bernie Sanders lecture about socialism, and he just shook his head and said, socialism does nothing but destroy. And part of the reason is, every socialist ideology, okay, there's a difference between the system. The system is how power and money is controlled. And by the way, there's a misnomer, a misunderstanding about capitalism. Every form of government is capitalist. The question is who controls the capital. There's money in Russia. There's money in China. They exchange. The question is, do the individuals own the fruits of their labor? Or does the government confiscate the fruits of their labor and then redistribute it according to the desires and the needs of the government? See, even Marx himself understood that before the perfect system, you know, he too imagined, like John Lennon, he too imagined the perfect world, right? But he understood that before they could get there, there had to be what he called the dictatorship of the proletariat. There had to be extreme violence and control by a handful of the true believers before they could then create the perfect world that they imagined. Every socialist, from Hitler to Lenin to Stalin to Marx, imagined the perfect world. You know, we associate all these atrocities with socialism, whether it was Hitler's socialism, whether it was Stalin's socialism, whether it was Mao's socialism, or even what goes on in North Korea. You know, we imagine these as a reflection of their ideology. But they all had different ideologies. They all envisioned a different perfect world. Right? Hitler's perfect world was not the same perfect world as Stalin and Marx, which was not the same perfect world as, by the way, other supremacist movements like the Islamicists. The crimes and atrocities they commit are not based on their ideology. It's based on a socialist system that even in its perfect rendering, even in its original founding document, knew that first you had to commit atrocities. And that's the stage we're at right now. Right? These atrocities, these crimes that the democratic socialists are committing on the streets, or even, you know, short of crimes, their lies in the newspapers. They don't imagine a world where they're going to have to continue to lie all the time. They don't imagine a world where they're going to continue to set cities on fire the whole time. This stage that we're at now is the dictatorship of the proletariat.
This is a key point, and a number of other things you've just said are as well, and I want to touch on each of them before we turn to sort of the vision thing, if you will. George H.W. Bush used to call it the vision thing, but the ultimate objectives of these various socialists or supremacists, more to the point. But you mentioned that we're dealing with democratic socialists in the streets of the United States, burning buildings and attacking police officers and so on. And I wonder if you could define these terms a little bit further, Evan, because most of these are folks who are branding themselves not as democratic socialist, but as Antifa, or perhaps Black Lives Matter, the organization, and the peaceful protesters, I guess, would say that they're part of Black Lives Matter, too. But the organization itself is its leaders have self-described themselves and each other as Marxist. So where do you get that they're democratic socialists, which the last time I checked is what Bernie Sanders described themselves as?
Two essential points here, and I hope I remember both of them. No matter where you find a supremacist movement, whether it was Hitler's supremacism, whether it was in the Old South and white supremacism, you have your paramilitary, quasi-independent groups that go around beating people up and destroying things. Right? Under Hitler's socialism, they called themselves the Brown Shirts. They didn't call themselves necessarily Nazis. They were the Brown Shirts. In the Democratic Party controlled Old South, they called themselves the Ku Klux Klan. Now, the vast majority of supporters of that supremacy weren't members of the Ku Klux Klan, didn't engage in that kind of violence. But this, what's key here is neither did they stand up against it. And it was William Buckley who said, every movement is going to have its lone crazies. The way you can tell if the lone crazy is just that, outside of the mainstream and crazy, or a reflection of the movement itself, is the response of the mainstream to the acts of the crazy. And you don't see virtually anybody on the left who is repudiating the violence, who is trying to moderate the violence. In fact, they are acting, aiding and abetting it by their lies and their cover-ups. So, yes, it's only a handful, you know, the 10% I talked about who are out in the streets breaking glass like it's Kristallnacht. But the fact that they are not being rebuked by their own, in fact, they're being aided and abetted by supremacist mayors like Pete Wheeler in Oregon. The fact that that de Blasio is painting their murals in front of Tower, he's not breaking windows, but he's aiding and abetting the propaganda that allows them to continue.
So this is a very important point, it seems to me, Evan, and I'm so appreciative of your helping connect dots, because at the end of the day, we're endlessly told that Nazis, which of course was the shorthand of National Socialists, were on the right, and that communists are on the left, and socialists or democratic socialists are kind of in the center, center left maybe. But what you basically have laid out here is, first of all, that National Socialism was a socialist operation, and Hitler was very clear about that, particularly early on in his career, and that it's all of the left and it's all of the hard left, basically, is it not? Especially when you start looking at what their objectives ultimately are, the end state, not just the violent transition of the workers' paradise, but the end state itself is pretty horrific.
Yeah, I mean, the argument that the left makes is that Hitler was the wrong kind of socialist, that he was a national socialist, and the emphasis was on his nationalism. And therefore, like Donald Trump, who says, make America great, and the rest of us who are nationalists, who believe in secure borders and universal rights for citizens, somehow and American exceptionalism. But one thing I want you to take note of, while the left always promises paradise, a workers' paradise, they always promise utopia, people on the right don't promise utopia. We talk about American exceptionalism, not American perfection. We talk about making America great, not perfect. It's in one part the utopianism of Hitler. And it might not be how you and I envision utopia, but to the socialists, to those who employed the socialist system of Hitler, that was paradise. Just like those who employed the socialist system of Marx, that was the paradise they envisioned.
This is a key point. We'll come back to it right after a short break. Evan Sayet is in the house virtually. He is talking, among other things, about his powerful new book-length essay entitled The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. We'll drill down on it a bit further. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with Evan Sayet. He is both deadly serious and wildly funny, and brings both of these together in his appearances, places like the Heritage Foundation, notably in the former category, and on stages across America, at least when it's not in lockdown, as part of his The Right to Laugh, a Night of Conservative Comedy program. But we're speaking to him about something that's very much in that former category, the deadly serious business of what is happening to our republic at the moment, at whose hands, and to what end. This is the subject of his new book, The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. And Evan, again, thank you so much for giving so generously of your time to discuss these really important topics. We're discussing sort of what makes these utopians tick, these true believers, as you rightly point out, are people who know full well what they're up to and are basically seeking to impose their particular brand of supremacism on others by violence, necessarily, at the outset, at least. I wanted to ask you about a particular type of enabling that is much in evidence at the moment. And I want to get your help in clarifying who are these people and what's motivating them and where do they think this will lead. They're often described as globalists. Quite a number of them are prominent figures in Wall Street. One of the most eminent of them is a fellow by the name of Larry Fink. He is the founder and CEO of an enormously successful financial firm called BlackRock. And he has made it his business to use the power of BlackRock's vast investments in corporate America to try to bend boardrooms across this country to his will, which is to embrace something called the Environment, Social Justice, and Governance, or ESG for short, agenda, by which he has in mind, you know, imposing AOC's Green New Deal and otherwise essentially advancing, well, what I think is pretty much the hard left, socialist, etc. agenda. I don't know how closely you've tracked what Larry Fink is doing or people like him to advance this program, but how does that fit into the socialist enterprise that you're warning about that's at the core of this woke supremacy in America?
I wouldn't put Fink amongst the enablers. I would put him amongst the true believers, in that he is not falling for the propaganda. He is intentionally propagandizing. He has his own globalist end that I don't think the vast majority of people, let's just start with enabling as being voting for the Democrats. Simply pulling the lever for the Democrats is enabling this. And I don't think the vast majority who are going to pull the lever for the D, who are going to vote for empowering Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, have the same vision, have the same knowledge, have the same understanding of the end game that people like Fink have. When I talk about the enablers, I'm talking about people who have been so steeped in the orthodoxies and the narratives of the movement. So I would call them, for example, the students and not the history professor like Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn acknowledges that what he's putting out there is propagandist lies. He acknowledges it. He says objectivity is undesirable. If you think that history should serve a social purpose, if you think that history should in some way advance the causes of humanity, then you make the choices based on that. So Zinn would be a true believer, somebody who's knowingly lying. An enabler in the way I'm describing it is more like a Bruce Springsteen. You know, Springsteen isn't a globalist necessarily. I don't think he's given it 2 seconds thought. I don't think he's a socialist. He certainly doesn't live like a socialist. But nonetheless, when he wrote his song Born in the USA, where he slanders America and says that we entered that war because we wanted to kill the yellow man. All right, that's something he's simply repeating without giving it a moment's thought. Because if he'd given it a moment's thought, he would have known that, of course, while the North Vietnamese did in fact have yellow skin, so too did the South Vietnamese who we were fighting for and with.
And seeking to assure retained freedom until they were basically betrayed by, you know, the socialists in this country and the people they bent to their will. And that's the real tragedy, is yellow people, if you wish to use that racist expression, suffered at the hands of other yellow people because we were defeated in that war.
That's absolutely true. And then when the people who did the right thing, who went over to Vietnam and risked so much and gave up so much, returned home, it was the same democratic socialists who spit in their faces, who called them all kinds of names, and who made their lives miserable. And they, too, I don't believe were necessarily true believers. The ones who did that are the same ones who rip out a 7-year-old sign at the convention, the same ones who knock a hat off of somebody, the same one who spit in the food before they deliver it to somebody. You know, you certainly don't compare those wrongs with the wrongs of the Nazi regime. But on the other hand, A, they are wrongs, and B, we're still prior to the revolution. You know, all the atrocities committed by the others weren't committed until they had the full power, money, and authority of the government.
But some were, initially, some were before all of that came to be. But what you're saying basically is whether you are a true believer or whether you are an enabler, as long as you are advancing in whatever role you play, this totalitarian agenda, you're an enemy of freedom and you are seeking to bring it down. And that's what we're seeing, it seems to me, in the streets of the United States today with this revolutionary fervor at the hands of socialists and communists and Marxists and Black Lives Matter.
And those who do those things don't see themselves in the same way that they see the others who committed similar crimes and enabled similar socialist movements, because they don't look at the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's just a step. They don't even think about it. They're thinking about their original purpose, and their original purpose is this perfect world as John Lennon sang about it.
I want to come to that. Pause with me just for a second, because you have a particularly powerful quote that Mark Tapson, in his excellent review of your book at frontpagemag.com, pulled out as an excerpt. And I just want to read it to our audience and have you comment if you would. You say, quote, "Not all globalists are socialists, but all socialists are globalists." And you pick up on this point, quote, "While this taking over the world stuff might sound like the dreams of only madmen, sociopaths, and megalomaniacs, and not at all what today's socialists in America would want to do, it is in fact the end game of every socialist, whether he screeches it with vicious vitriol like Hitler, delivers it in market-tested soundbites like Elizabeth Warren, or sets it to a happy tune like John Lennon," unquote. Walk us through that, because that really, in a nutshell, defines the character of the problem we're up against, it seems to me.
Yeah, no matter the socialist system, and again, one of the most important things that my book-length essay, I like that you called it that, that's pretty much what it is, a book-length essay, tries to make abundantly clear that ideologies that embrace socialism have been vastly different. And the fact that the ideal, the ideology of today's socialist is a better world, a better utopia than the others promised, is almost irrelevant. Because first, to get there, there are three prerequisites. There are three requisites for utopia, no matter what description of utopia that socialist uses. The three requirements are that there be no personal possessions, that there be no countries, and that there be no religion. All right, that was what Hitler wanted. He was a globalist. He wanted to rule the entire world. He didn't want nation states. He didn't want other religions. Obviously, it's what Marx calls for. It's what we have in China. Well, those three requisites for utopia that John Lennon sang about, he wants us all to imagine that world. They're also the same three requisites for the totalitarianism and the authoritarianism that the socialist system has never once failed to bring, no matter the ideology. And it's because without personal possessions, the individual doesn't have the resources to stand up to an oppressive government. Without countries, there are no other governments to stand up to the globalist leaders. And without religion, there is no higher moral authority to countermand the dictates of the globalist leaders.
And the evil, for that matter, of those dictators.
You know, the evil, or even if on the other hand, it turns out that they're the benevolent dictators. You know, even if it turns out John Lennon does get to rule the world. Once you then get into the practicalities of trying to fit one size fits all, and with all the people sharing the same ideology, it requires not only the dictatorship of the proletariat to get there, but then it requires the same violence to maintain it. You know, you look at Big Brother in 1984, and even once Big Brother had taken over government in all forms of government in every possible way, they still had to have that authoritarianism and totalitarianism to keep people marching in lockstep.
It fundamentally, doesn't it? It comes down to, it has to be compulsion that makes people live in these conditions, particularly when it turns out it isn't a paradise for anybody, let alone the workers. It is a pretty awful place, with the exception, of course, of whatever the supremacist elite may be, whether it's communists or whether it's, dictators of some other stripe, national socialists, perhaps. It still comes down to they've got it pretty good. Everybody else is suffering terribly. And that's the subject to which we will return in a moment with Evan Sayet. We're going to talk in particular about the anti-Semitic quality of so many of these totalitarian dictatorships and their globalist agenda. Let's do that right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to our fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily thoughtful and important, very timely for sure, conversation with Evan Sayet. You can find his collected works on the internet, particularly in places like the Heritage Foundation's archives, his remarkable speech there about a previous book and teachings that he's been doing. They call it The Kindergarten of Eden. But we're talking today about a brand new book, and as I said, couldn't be more topical, entitled The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. Evan, tell us how people can get the book.
Yeah, well, first of all things Evan Sayet can be found at evansayet.com, EVANSSAMAYET. But if you go there and you want to buy the book, it's just going to send you to Amazon anyway. So if you want to see more about me, go to evansayet.com. If you just want to buy, it's available as an ebook for downloading. It's available in print, and we're working on an audiobook.
So, Evan, we were talking a little bit just before the last break about some of the unsavory features of this socialist utopianism. And one is that it invariably, it seems, has as a component part anti-Semitism. Why is that? And is it indeed in the nature of this kind of oppressive program that it must hate religions, all religions, but some more than others, notably that of the Jewish faith?
Yeah, look, every supremacist movement needs a scapegoat, a image to be so hated that the rank and file don't look at the behaviors that they would likely find appalling if they weren't so filled with hate for others. You know, perfect example is in 1984. I mean, this is just a fictionalized story, and yet nonetheless, Big Brother provides the people of Oceania with Goldstein and the 2 minutes hate, where these people who otherwise have had everything sucked out of their lives by the socialist, totalitarian, authoritarian government are so focused on their hate and vitriol. And Jews always serve a good purpose in this way for those kinds of movements, because both their minuscule numbers and their unusually high level of accomplishment make them both visible and something to be jealous of. And of course, jealousy is the driving force of socialism. You know, and well, the jealousy turns to hate because these people who are superior are not getting the things that superior people deserve. So therefore, it's blaming the Jews. But Judaism is singled out for enmity amongst the left. It is endemic amongst the left. Obviously, in Hitler's socialist Germany, Soviet Jewry during the Cold War, the BDS movement, which is designed to finish Hitler's work by strangling economically the Jews of the world to death.
And particularly the Jewish state, of course, of Israel, which has got quite a number of other people who'd like to wipe the Jews out from that place.
Yeah, so they sort of get two for one. They wipe out they get three for one. You know, they wipe out a religion, they eliminate a country, and of course, because America is Judeo-Christian, they undermine Western civilization and the world as it is. That is always their first goal, is to destroy the world as it is, which is why you find such odd alliances and allegiances. You know, Hitler allied with the Mufti of Jerusalem. Now, that seems an awfully odd alliance, given the fact that Hitler's utopia was a world without Semites. And yet, Arabs are Semites. You know, you look at the Soviet Union, who was the greatest benefactor of the Islamists during the Cold War, which would seem odd, given that the Soviets wanted a world without religion, and yet they were siding with religious fanatics. And you look at the Democratic Socialists today, and they claim to want a world without racism and sexism and homophobia, and yet they side with the movement that throws gays off of buildings and subjugates women.
Another odd phenomenon, but we won't have time to develop it here because I do want to talk to you about what we do about all this, is the high number of Jews who are socialists in this country and in the Soviet Union and for a time even in Hitler and Marx himself, of course. So this is a mystery that we will reflect on and come back to you on hopefully soon, Evan. But I did want to close this very, very important conversation with you by just inviting you to talk a little bit about what does a nation like America do as it finds itself confronting now fifth column movements attacking its cities, destroying federal property and statues and history and people, for that matter, sometimes with murderous effect. Obviously, your book is an important guide to why they're doing this and what they seek. But what would you recommend the rest of us do in the face of this kind of revolutionary activity?
The very, very first thing we must all do is recognize, understand, and embrace the fact that this is, in fact, war. This is not the loyal opposition. These are people who quite literally declared war. We didn't get into it, but this right now is the coming of age, the fruition of the 60s radicals who literally declared war on America. Bernardine Dorn approached the bank of microphones and said, "Hi, I'm Bernardine Dorn, and I'm going to read to you a declaration of war." So the first thing you have to recognize is that the things that you do, the things that you would embrace, the actions you would take are different when you're fighting a war than when you're debating relative rates of taxation. These people seek our destruction. So then, and by the way, by any means necessary, those are their words.
And when you say our destruction, you mean both the country, the constitutional republic in which we all are happily residing, or the vast majority of us are at least, as well as us as individuals?
As well as us as individuals, and in fact, the entire history of humanity. You know, just like if the Nazis had won, they would have destroyed all evidence of previous and other ideologies, cultures. Just like if the Islamicists were to succeed in the global caliphate, they would destroy all evidence of any and all other ideologies, religion, systems. Their goal, too, which is why during their the latest socialist rampage, it wasn't just racist statues that they tore down. They went to destroy Abraham Lincoln, right? So it made no difference to them because their war is actually against humanity. And in fact, they identified this themselves when they called themselves the counterculture. Their goal is to counter culture. And so once you realize, and good is always at a disadvantage against evil because good is constrained by goodness. Well, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to be a little less good. We have to stop pretending that this is even really a democracy at the moment, because a democracy requires democratic institutions. You know, they voted in the Soviet Union. They voted in Iraq, I think 98% for Saddam Hussein. It's not the vote that makes you democratic. But and when you have a propagandizing media, when you have an indoctrinating school system, that we can't just wait till November, pull the lever, and then abide by the results.
Even if the results are going to be known, I was in the room when Donald Trump on Thursday unveiled a very chilling scenario, which he says there's a theory might operate if these leftists, these revolutionaries, the Nancy Pelosi's and her postal service and their, you know, universal ballots being mailed and so on, have their way. The cumulative effect of this will be to ensure there is no resolution to the election for weeks, possibly months. And he pointed out that according to this theory, the president did, come January 20th, the person who may be our next president of the United States under our Constitution would be Nancy Pelosi. A chilling thought. Here's the bottom line, and you have really painted a very alarming picture, but it is one that we need to be exposed to. You've, I think, documented admirably the nature of socialism, that it is a lie, fundamentally, and it is a lie that is intended to be foisted upon all of us through violence and intimidation by both true believers and their enablers. It is a lie that will destroy our country if they have their way. It is a lie that will enslave us and must be therefore resisted as though everything, including our lives as well as our country, is on the line. Evan, let me simply say thank you for today's important, timely, and extremely informative conversation with you about the new book, The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. Congratulations on it. Check it out, folks, and everything else that Evan has done at evansayet.com. Evan, EvanSayet.com. Thank you, my friend. Godspeed. Keep up the good work, and may you sell millions of copies. We'll look forward to talking with you soon, and looking forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.